So the main new results in this talk that I'll be discussing are joined with Jeff Cheeger and Bruce Kleiner. But I'll be mentioning many other results along the way as background, which I will explain what is the correct way to prove them as I mentioned them. I want to state first a very concrete geometric theorem and then dedicate a significant part of the talk to a discussion of what it means and why we care about this theorem before actually proving it. So in order to do that, I need some very minimal notation. So if you have two metric spaces, then I'll denote then C sub y of x is going to be the smallest distortion which you can embed x into y. So it's the infimum over numbers d, such that there exists some lambda. This is just a scaling factor. And a function f from x to y, such that the distances in the image are roughly this this lambda multiple of the original distance up to your error d. And this should hold for every 2 points in a metric space x. And of course, x will always be a Banach space in which you can always normalize the function by lambda, so this scaling factor is completely irrelevant when you can normalize. Okay, so this is just in the context of general metric spaces. So this is called, this parameter is a number which measures how close x is to be, in the Bay-Lipschitz sense, to be a subset of y. Okay? And I guess maybe I should say that when y is an LP space, so from now on, when I write LP, I will mean LP under interval 0, 1. If the back measure, this contains isometrically all separable LP spaces, so this is going to be the one we're going to be discussing. So if y is LP, then I'll just write C sub y of x as C sub p of x. And really, the parameter that we're going to be caring about in this talk is C sub 1. The best way that you can represent x as a subset of L1, you may ask yourself why. I will hopefully convince you that there is no choice. We need to understand this for certain questions. So this is the L1 distortion of x. And I should just say that C sub 2, which is a in many senses a more natural and a much more well-behaved parameter. This is the case when you're trying to embed x into a Hilbert space. So this is called the Euclidean distortion of x. And we might say a few words about it, but we really care about this parameter. Okay. So that's all the notation I need in the theorem. Consider the Heisenberg group, the discrete Heisenberg group for now. H, which is just all the upper triangular matrices with integer entries. And GW is going to be the word metric with respect to some fixed symmetric set of generators. So, for concreteness, just choose your favorite set of generators. So, all the possibilities of putting plus minus one in one of these coordinates. That's even too many generators, but whatever I'm going to say is going to be up to huge constants, so it's irrelevant which set of generators you choose. But fix it from now on. So, the two theorems I want to discuss is measurements and how far away this geometry, H with the metric. The word metric is from L1. There are several ways to do this, but the one which will be most crucial, so this is this theorem with Cheever and Kleiner, is that if I look at the metric space, very simple metric space to describe, it's the all the matrices with, let's say, whose coefficients are in the numbers 1 to n, this with the word metric, then this number is at least log n to C, where C is a universal constant. Okay, so I'm claiming that this grows like log n to some power, and we'll see what this means very soon. Of course, there's more. When you discuss an infinite object, there is more than one way to measure how far it is from being L1 or L2. So we can also discuss the same proof gives a compression version of this, or an asymptotic version of this. So again, a tiny bit of notation. If I have a function f from H to L1, then I'll define omega f of t is the largest function such that fx minus fy then 1 is at least this function of their distance, this word distance. And if you have this notation, then the theorem becomes the theorem is that if f from h when 1 is Lipschitz in the metric d omega, dw, the word metric, then this its lower modulus must decay to infinity like t over log t to some power. C again is a universal constant. Okay, so it's far from Lipschitz in these two senses. Okay? And this will be both corollaries of the same theorem when I look. Okay? This is nice. Does not require a different work. Okay. So the statement's clear. So the main question, which I hope you're asking yourselves, and you should, is why? Why do we care about embeddings into L1? Why do we, as you will see, work quite hard to prove estimates of this type? And I want to dedicate some time to explain why this is a very natural question, why it occurs naturally, in a sense, we have no choice. And and later on, when we actually get into the proof, we're going to see other reasons why. For technical reasons, this is, in a sense, a test case. Yeah.
This, I guess, you mean for sequence of TN going to
infinity? No. Yeah. You're right. Then, so I guess the way, if I define it this way, I want to make it increasing. So I guess okay, the way it's in, the way I actually define another way I'm used to it. So okay, but the real way to define it is to define the lower modulus as the is the omega of t is the is the is an increasing function such that this is at least omega of t when dxy is at least t, and then you will get what I wrote. But this is just I wrote a non-standard definition. But you good for spot. Where was I? Okay, so why? There will be several reasons. Some of them will come up as we discuss how we go about proving such results, and we'll see that there are natural barriers that need to be overcome when proving these theorems, or we'll state this, but this will be for later. So L1 is a test case. So for certain types of arguments, and we'll have to get into the argument to explain what I mean by this, but this is really crossing a barrier for certain types of arguments, that, and we need and it requires, it's a question that requires really overcoming something which is famous and old, which is a problem which is famous and old, and we'll have, the only way for me to explain this is actually getting to the proof, so I will discuss one. Two, and that is the thing I want to discuss first, is that applications to combinatorial optimization and I want to explain what this means. In order to do that, I'll have to digress a little bit, but these applications are not fake in the sense that the problem of embedding into L1 certain metrics is completely equivalent. It's an if and only if statement. It's equivalent to a problem in theoretical computer science. So there is absolutely no choice but to solve this problem, and this is what I want to explain now. So the problem that I want to discuss and to convince you that the L1 shows up is what's called the sparsest graph problem. It's very simple to describe, and it will look familiar very soon to many of you. So, but the problem itself is very simple. So, you have two functions. So, let's say C and capital D are two functions. Zero infinity. Let's make them symmetric. Symmetric in their coordinates. And if you have such two functions and you have a subset S, let's say a proper subset which is not empty, then we can define phi of S to be the following ratio. So this is a funny way to do something, to write something simple. So let's say S is everything on this side. This is S. Then I get a non-zero. This is one sub S is the indicator of the set S. So I get a non-zero contribution only if I is in S and J is not in S, or vice versa. The numerator is the total sum weight of the function C for pairs which cross the boundary of S, and the same for the function D, that's the denominator. Okay, so these letters are standard. C's are called capacities, D's are called demands. You don't really need to know where this is coming from, even though it might be clear in a bit. But this measures the total capacity crossing the boundary divided by the total demand crossing the boundary. But for us, these are just two functions, so we don't need to know the meaning of the names. And
And the parameter I care about, phi star of these two functions, is just the minimum of phi over all subsets. So just to explain, so to make it look a bit more familiar, let's investigate a special, a very important special case. Special case. So usually in the literature, in the combinatorics literature, they don't write it like this. What they do is they emphasize the support of the function capital C. So the pairs for which capital C is non-zero. Because it's a symmetric function, it's just a graph. It's a set of pairs of numbers where it's non-zero. So if we emphasize the support of Cij, then a different way to see this is so this is just completely different way to write it, so different formulation. So you have G is a graph and the numbers 1 to n with some edges. So these are just the set of pairs where the function capital C is non-zero. And then for every edge E in E, there is a number C of E, which is a capacity, and there is a number, and then for every pair of vertices I and J, there is a number DRJ, and I want to minimize the same thing, except that in the numerator I will write some IJs and A. C of IJ. This is really not, and the denominator is over all pairs. So I didn't do anything, but there is a special case which in which there are actually no interesting numbers happening here. So all the numbers are one when they are non-zero. So the case of uniform demand, is the case when C of E is 1 and Dij is 1, identity. Okay? So C is still an interesting function because it has an interesting support, but that's all. Okay? This is just everything else is 1. In this case, if we stare at this for a moment or the interpretation up here, there is an obvious, oh, that's phi of S. So the obvious interpretation is that phi of s, well, rewriting it is, so the numerator, now these are all ones, so I'm just counting how many pairs I and j, one is in the set and j is not in the set, so I have the number of edges joining s and its complement divided by all the denominators are all one, so I get exactly the size of S times the size of the complement of S. Okay, so computing phi star in this case, which is the minimum of this thing, is just solving the isoperimetric problem on the graph. Finding the set with minimum ratio of the size of the boundary, the number of edges going outside, to its size. Okay, so this is really solving the isoperimetric problem, and the way to interpret the original problem is I'm allowed to choose to weight my pairs differently, and that's actually absolutely crucial for applications. Sometimes you have pairs that you really want not to separate. So You can encode all kinds of problems this way by choosing the numbers. The way people, okay, so that is just numbers so far. Let me tell you what the sparsest cut problem is. So, so what's really known as the sparsest cut problem is it's an algorithmic problem. I'll say a few words about this in a second. So given C and D, your two functions, compute, or maybe estimate, the number in polynomial time. Okay, so polynomial in n, and I guess in the length of the representations of the numbers, the n squared numbers of all. Okay? Now, we'll see in a second what it's, we'll say something about polynomial time. The reason I wrote estimate versus compute exactly is, you know, it's still a very interesting problem to compute it, not estimate it, except that this is p equals np. So so it's old and actually easy that computing phi star of cd exactly is np hard. So it's still a great question, but that's not the question we're going to be talking about. We're going to be, instead of computing it exactly, we're going to be estimating it. I guess more recent, in 2007, Chuzoy and Hanna proved that there exists some fixed universal constant, epsilon zero. I don't remember what it is, let's say 0.001. I don't remember what it is. Such that if you could compute phi star of CD up to a factor less than 1 plus epsilon 0, then p equals np. So you're never going to be able to even get, so there is some error that you're going to have to make if you believe that p is not equal. Okay? And so what I'm showing, I hope to be able to get this again, because it's quite remarkable. So I'm going to be vague here. They gave evidence that you cannot compute phi star up to any constant. And by evidence, at this point it means that if you could get a constant factor approximation to this problem, so let's say factor a million, then yes, you will be very famous because you solved the sparsest cut problem, but you'll be much more famous because you will solve a much more central problem to computer science. You'll actually disprove a much more central problem to computer science. So this is some evidence that there is something bigger happening behind this. So as I said, so this is a very, very central problem in computer science. The reason it's central is that the way these types of algorithms are appearing all over the place, there are books about them, and the way they're used in computer science is always the obvious way, essentially always the obvious way. If you want to solve a big problem and you don't know what to do, then the simplest way would be, okay, let's chop it up into two smaller problems and solve them recursively. And in any such approach, which is called divide and conquer in computer science,
For any such approach, you always have to set up the problem in this way so that when you chop up the problem into two pieces, you minimize the interface between the pieces. You don't want to create problems when you glue partial solutions together, and that's how you use those C's and those D's. You adapt them to the problems. Those of you who are interested in this, there is a very nice book which has many, many applications of these things that I can give reference to what you're interested. But for me, I am interested in algorithms. As you will see, if you do not care about algorithms, all the theorems that I'm going to be showing you right now, even though there are statements about algorithms, there are actually interesting geometric inequalities. You have some quantity, let's say, this quantity, phi star of CD up there, and you're going to bound it by all kinds of by quantities, which it happens to be true that you can compute them efficiently, but even just the inequalities that people are interested in mathematically, the algorithm is not necessarily the main interest of the result. Okay, so I want to explain this, and I want to show how N1 and the Heisenberg group comes in. So, in order to explain it, we start with an old observation of linear London and Rabinovich. So, here is a way L1 comes in. So the appearance of L1 is due to linear London and Rabinovich in 95. And they said the following, so it's a lemma. It's really an easy lemma. It says that for every CND, if the number phi star of CND equals the following thing, I'm going to minimize over all n functions in L1 the following term. Okay, so what I'm doing here is I'm running over all choices of n functions in L1, let's say the interval 0, 1, and I'm computing a similar ratio to what I wrote before, except that it's smoothed out. Instead of having a 0, 1 term here, I just have the distance from the I function to the j function in L1. And this is the nature of this field, or of this type of problem. This is an equality. So I didn't lose anything, and I will not lose anything in any of the reductions that I'm going to show you. Everything will be if and only if conditions. So this is an identity. I will explain in a second how to prove it. It's not hard at all. What does it tell us? It really tells us something which is maybe a little bit sad, that because we know that computing this guy is NP-hard, then minimizing over functions in L1 is also NP-hard, because it's an identity. Okay, so it doesn't, because it's an identity, it really doesn't give us something new, but it will give us an idea. But let me tell you why this is true. So there is something called the cut cone representation. Which says that a metric space, XD, is isometric to a subset of L1 if and only if for every subset S of your set of your metric space there is a non-negative weight such that if I want to compute, so for every 2 points X and Y, if I want to compute the distance from x to y, this is the same as summing over all subsets. And then I have lambda sub s.
Okay, so so if I want, for, being a subset of L1 is the same thing as being a superposition of these trivial types of semimetrics. If the sum of the lambda, the way to understand this is that if the sum of the lambda S's, let's say summed up to one, this is just normalization, then what you're saying is being a subset of L1 is the same thing as finding a probability distribution over subsets of your metric space, such that if you want to compute the distance between X and Y, this is the same as computing the probability that a random subset contains X and not Y, or vice versa. Okay, so, but this is if and only if, and the way you prove this is, it's in the name. It's, first of all, you can give closed formulas for these lambda sub S's, but the, you know, the conceptual reason for this is that being a subset of L1, so if you have endpoints in L1, then matrices of the form, the L1 distance between Fi and Fj, form a cone in the space of n by n matrices. So the sum of two such matrices is still a matrix of this type. This is where I'm using L1 and not L2. And the reason is that if I have two matrices of this type, let's say corresponding to Fi and Gi, then I can concatenate, I can just put Fi and Gi in disjoint supports in L1, and the distances will add up. So this is a cone, any cone is generated by its extreme rays, and the extreme rays are just the 0-1 matrix. It's a very easy exercise. So this is what this is saying. Okay? Just, okay. So, oh yeah, and once you have this lemma, then this other lemma is a trivial corollary. Just write for your subset f1 up to fn, find these weights, plug it into the formula, and you'll see that the worst case is when the f's are actually indicators of subsets. So we didn't really get anywhere because we wrote an identity, but, and this is an important idea of London, linear London Rabinovich, and independently of Aumann and Rabbani, one thing that you can say is you can, okay, I do not know, because of this identity, it's impossible to minimize over subsets of L1, but a particular property of being a subset of L1 is that you're a metric space. So we can look at the following quantity. So define M star, let's say of CD, CD, this is gonna be the following, the minimum of the following quantity, sum ij, cij, dij, given. So first of all, this is just normalization. I'm normalizing the denominator to be 1. And I'm just going to write down the conditions which say that dij is a semimetric. So dii 0, dij equals dji for all I and j, and for all I, j, and k, dij is at most dik plus dkj. Okay? So, maybe I should compare. This is, I can always minimize the same thing given the fact that the denominator is 1. This is just normalization. So what I want is the minimum of this given the fact that the denominator is 1. And these weights, these smoothing weights, which were before L1 distances, they're now just a metric. And I can write down what it means to be a metric. And the key observation is that everything I wrote down here is a linear inequality. Or an identity, so two linear inequalities. So this is a linear inequality in these variables, these n choose two variables. These are all linear conditions. And how many of them are there? Polynomially many, roughly n cubed is the biggest one, right? So this is what's called a linear program, minimizing a linear function of even polynomially many linear constraints, and this can be done in polynomial time. So n star can be computed in polynomial time. This is a linear program. Now, what else can I say about this number m star? So I guess that was the whole start of the discussion. M star of CD is clearly less than phi star of CD, right? Just because of minimizing over all metrics, not only subsets of L1. So the whole game is, even if you don't care about algorithms, is what is, can we give a lower bound here? Okay, and this was done long ago. This is a famous theorem called Bourdain's embedding theorem. Studied for completely unrelated reasons, and it says that if X is an n-point metric space, then is at most, I don't know, 100 log n, a constant times log n. Okay, so you can embed any n-point space with a multiplicative distortion log n into L1, and then what you do, then if dij star is the minimizer of, is the metric for which m star is attained, then you use Bourdain's theorem to put it inside L1. Okay, it's n points in L1, so it's n functions. I erase it f1 up to fn. And the fact that all the distances are up to a factor log n the same, and we only care about distances, you think about it for half a second, and you see this. You get that m star of CD is at least to a constant phi star of CD over log n, due to our lemma, which said that in L1, is that clear? This is very important thing. We need, so here is the first occurrence of, well, in this application, of the need to embed a metric into L1, and this metric we absolutely know nothing about it. How do we know about the maximizer or minimizer of dij star? The only thing we know about it is what we ensure, is that it's a metric. It's completely abstract metric on an endpoint, on endpoints. We have absolutely no control what it is. And our entire goal, because of this identity, which says phi star is related to L1, is to embed this abstract object into L1. So, and luckily we can do it. And what does this say? It says, well, luckily this quantity m star can be computed efficiently. And if I compute it, then I'm guaranteed to know the truth, phi star up to a factor log n, log the number of points. Okay, so this is the kind of thing, this is one of the nice aspects of this problem. So this is
So the problem of computing phi star is a problem of solving the isoperimetric problem. Computing it in polynomial time means I give you some geometry, and you have to, well, in particular, look at a tiny, tiny, tiny fraction of all possible subsets, only polynomially many, there are 2 to the n of them. You need to look at a tiny fraction of them and say, just by looking at this tiny fraction of them, the solution to the isoperimetric problem is the following. So this is some sort of we need to somehow restrict our research space, and here we managed to hit the mark using this geometric theorem of Bourguin up to log n. Now, unfortunately, Bourguin's theorem is tight, so it cannot be improved. You cannot get better than log n, so this approach ends. But of course, what it tells us is that in order to proceed, we need to have more geometry on this metric that we're trying to embed into L1. A priori, it was just one metric space, arbitrary metric space. And if I impose more geometric restrictions, I will manage to get a better embedding into L1. So, and this is actually true. So this is a beautiful idea of Gomez and Linear. They suggested a quadratic variant of this problem. But in order to motivate it, I need to, again, state a very easy lemma. For reference, it says the following: the metric space L1 is the metric x minus y, but I take the square root of the distance, is isometric L2. Okay, so this is a very easy fact. Later, if somebody wants to see it, it's a one-line proof. Okay, but so L1 is related to L2 via the property that the root of the distance is in L2. So what Gomez and Linnell suggested is to do something very similar. So define M double star is the mean to be the minimum of same thing given, well, really the same thing and that Dij is a metric, is a semi-metric, so the same qualities as I wrote before, such that root of Dij is isometric to a subset of L2. Okay? So I'm copying the thing up there with the additional information I have about L1, which is what I care about, which is the root of the metric is isometric to a subset of L2. Okay, algorithmically you need to check that this M double star can be computed in polynomial time, and it can. And the reason is that when you think for a second what this means on Dij, the fact that the root of Dij is isometric to a subset of L2 is the same as saying that Dij is of the form xi minus xj squared for some points in L2. That's the second thing, that the root of Dij is isometric. Xi are in L2. Okay, these are points in Hilbert space. And the fact that you have the triangle inequality now becomes a quadratic inequality on the xi's, given a quadratic constraint, and you're minimizing a quadratic function.
over all points in Hilbert space, and this can be done, this is called a semi-definite program, this can also be computed to arbitrarily good precision in polynomial time. Okay? So we care about this, and again, as before, by design, M double star of CD is always at most phi star of CD, just because I minimized over something which L1 satisfies. Okay. Phi star is the same in all subsets of L1. And also, M is also bigger than this, just because I added one more constraint, so maybe there is hope that we'll do better. Okay? And we can do better, so here's a theorem. This is due to Aurora, Lee, and myself. It says that if XD is an n-point metric space, such that root of D, X root of D, is isometric to a subset of L2, then C2 of X is at most log n to the power a half plus a little over.
There are iterated logs appearing because of this.
Now, observe that so Hilbert space is isometric to a subset of L1. That's again easy exercise, which I'm happy to show in the break if somebody wants to see. So in particular, the fact that I embedded into Hilbert space means that I embedded into L1, and if you just go through the same argument that I sketched before, you get as a corollary that M double star of CD is at least phi star of CD divided by roughly log n. And because we can compute this object, and we have also the upper bound, this gives us a way to compute the phi star in polynomial time up to root log the number of points in the space. And that's, at this, we're stuck now, this is the best known algorithm today. So we do not know any better algorithm for sparse Scott, and it's I think improving this will require major new ideas. I will maybe convince you now. But I guess, I don't know how many people in the audience are now kind of angry or, you know, unhappy about this theorem. Because, oh, maybe I should have said something, that this theorem is short. To the little O1 term that I wrote here. But the one half is sharp. Okay, so you cannot do better if you want this, if you want to do this. But of course, so this somehow says this is the end of the story, and indeed, this is the best we know how to do today. But the obvious objection is, why? Okay, it's sharp because we try to embed into a tiny space. Hilbert space is much smaller than L1. So it's sharp because we prove a statement which is much stronger than what we need. We need to embed into L1, not into L2. L2 is tiny. So the obvious question, so it was called the Gomez linear conjecture. is that if you have a metric space such that its root is isometric to subset of N2, then C1 of X is bigger than 1. And the reason they conjecture this is obviously this would finish the sort. This would finish the sources cut problem if you could do this. Right? Because that's what we really want. We want a constant factor approximation. So again, because I want to get to say a few words, I won't have much time to the Heisenberg group, I should say that Hot Vishnoi proved that the answer is no. This is really remarkable. There are absolutely beautiful ideas here. The bound that they get is log log n, so you can find an endpoint metric space of negative type, which has this property, that's called negative type, but which has this property, the root of the metric is isometric to a subset of L2, but its L1 distortion grows to infinity, like log log n, and the theorem, it follows from the proof, from the statement that they said about the Heisenberg group. Okay, maybe before that I should say, the theorem of Chigurh, Kleiber, and myself, which is a corollary of what I said, a non-trivial corollary, I would say one word about it, is that there exists C and D such that M double star of CD is too small. So is less than phi star of CD divided by log into the power. Okay, so this theorem, this is a corollary of the Heisenberg group's embedding question, it's really a corollary, I will explain in a second, says that this approach, this best known algorithm, is doomed to make an error sometimes by a power of log. Okay, and that's, so we both, this is the best known algorithm, but we also know that we're in trouble. We need to come up with a different approach if we want to solve this Bartoszkowski problem. So what is the connection to the Heisenberg group? So the connection was formalized in a paper with Lee, in which we proved that there exists a metric, an H, which is, let's say, 100 equivalent to the metric, to the word metric, and there exists a metric D, and root of D is isometric to a subset of N2. Okay? So, in particular, if you pass with this equivalent metric, this just the matrices with entries between 1 and n is it's completely equivalent to the original metric, so it still has distortion log n to some power in L1, but it is one of these geometries that occurred in the Gomanzinian approach. Okay, so this is the connection. And how you get from this the function C and D, I just don't have time to explain right now. It's actually a nice duality argument that that people in computer science, I think Yuri Rabinovich was the first to notice. They come separating hyperplanes between certain convex budgets. But you get them via duality argument. Okay. So I have 5 minutes, and I'm not going to do justice to the theorem, but I want to say a hint of what's going on in the proof of the non-embeddability theorem for the Heisenberg group.
So maybe I should say that the reason you want to look at that, there are many reasons you want to look at the Heisenberg group, and again, if I had more time, I would explain, in many formal senses, the Heisenberg group is the smallest possible counterexample to the Gomez-Zeno conjecture. You can really formalize this. So in a sense, this is an example which you should look at, and the other evidence is Pensou proved that H does not admit. Lipschitz embedding into L2, and you might hope that this can be somehow pushed to some information about L1. And this is the point where I said this is a known barrier. L1 is genuinely a barrier here. So again, this is just for those who know. The way Pensou proved this is by proving a variant, a non-commutative variant of the Vademacher differentiability theorem. So Lipschitz functions are almost everywhere differentiable. You just have to define what it means to be differentiable in the Heisenberg group. But differentiability theorems for L1 valued functions are just simply do not exist and cannot exist. And the simplest example you can look is the following kind of object. You map, it's actually an isometric embedding of the real line in L1. You map a number t to the indicator of the interval 0 to t. So because this is L1 and not any other LP, this is an isometric embedding of a line. This is just a geodesic in L1. And if you try to form difference functions, you're going to very quickly see that this cannot end one from L1 in any reasonable sense. You really cannot make sense of this. So there is no differentiability theory for L1 then functions. That is, until Cheever and Kleiner prove a substitute to differentiation. So, and this is a very deep idea. Essentially, what they're saying is that what you see over here, in a very formal sense, so a differentiability theorem says that locally a Lipschitz function looks nice. It looks like a linear function, or in Pensou's case, a group homomorphism, or something like that. What they're saying is that locally, any Lipschitz function in L1 looks like this, in a way that they need to formalize. So this bad example, this crazy arc that every time goes in a new orthogonal direction, is actually the canonical local behavior of Lipschitz function and the Heisenberg. What do I mean by this? So what I mean by this, so if you have a function f in the Heisenberg group into L1, then just by a continuous version of this cut cone representation that I wrote, there exists a measure. So you can write fx minus fy. So I look at the image of the Heisenberg group sitting inside L1. This is not a finite set, this is an infinite set. But there's still a complete analog of this cut cone representation. So we can write fx minus fy as the integral of the indicator this is, I guess, over measurable subsets, the space of measurable subsets from Heisenberg. Okay? A continuous Heisenberg. So this is just a continuous version of what I wrote before. Before it was a sum of weights, now it's going to be an integral. That's the only difference. And their idea is, if I want to prove a differentiation theory, I need instead of saying that difference quotients of f tend to something,
we're going to show that locally, the measure, this measure, this is called the cut measure of f, this measure sigma sub f is going to be essentially supported on sets with whichever nice shape. Okay, I want to say something nice about the shape of this subset, of the set on which it's supported locally at a very small scale. And so because I'm out of time, so locally, sigma f must be supported on half spaces. So again, I think I need to define what locally is. This is very easy to define, I'm just out of time. So this is what Chigurh and Kleiner proved, and the entire proof of this log n to some power is about getting a quantitative version of this statement. So you want to show, instead of locally, you want to estimate the scale at which this closeness to half spaces happens. And the main thing which you have to overcome is that this is not a quantitative problem, this is a qualitative difference. There is, behind the scenes, there's a classification of a certain measurable subsets of Heisenberg group, which if you do it in a quantitative world, in the quantitative world, you have a completely different classification that does not tend to the classification to the in the infinitesimal world. So there is some classification, some saying every subset of Heisenberg group satisfying certain properties, what they proved is actually a half space. But in the local world, in the quantitative world, the answer is it's either a half space or something else, and the something else is really there. So there is the answer is qualitatively different when you have to work in the finite case. And this is only for those who know. I'm sorry, I'm out of time. I'll be happy to explain in the end. I'm over by 2 minutes, 3 minutes.
Okay,
for generating, of course, yeah, conceive. I can conceive it. I have no idea what to do.
Yeah.
I have no idea.
That could happen.
Hmm?
That could happen.
You think it's true?
I'm just asking.
Yeah, but I have no idea why not, but I see absolutely no reason why yes. So, I have no idea.
Does the result extend to
I have no clue. So this is the proof is geometric measure theory in the Heisenberg group. There, it has many steps. I didn't put enough effort into trying to see which step extends. A lot of the computations are in coordinates specifically for the Heisenberg group. So this is just too soon to know. Currently, the proof is written in a way which is really specific to the Heisenberg group. You're obviously going to get, if you go to higher dimensional Heisenberg groups, you're going to get interesting dependence on the dimension of the Heisenberg group, which I have no idea what will happen there. There are all kinds of places where dimension will come in a bad way into the proof. But other groups, there are other issues. This is really, the fact that this is a group or the structure of the group is currently not something that we're looking at. It's really a problem in analysis or geometric measure theory. But I think that a lot of it will be extended, it just requires thought.
Thank you.